This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk to a lawyer from the New York Civil Liberties Union who is demanding why telephone agencies are giving away confidential information.
NSA spying reaching into your own homes. New Yorkers demand answers.
We'll talk to the Center for Constitutional Rights lawyer Rachel Mirapol about the Turkmen v. Ashcroft case.
Thousands of Arab and Muslim and South Asian men kidnapped up off the streets and held in secret detentions for months, in some cases years.
We'll hear a few segments from the National Lawyers Guild's recent symposium on the Green Scare.
Listen to these amazing speeches on the criminalization of environmental activism.
All that and more today on Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Last week, in a 5-3 decision, the Supreme Court ruled in the case of Hamdan v. Rumsfeld that President Bush had overstepped his authority in ordering military commission trials for foreign nationals held at Guantanamo Bay. The ruling held that the proposed commissions violated United States law as well as the Geneva Convention. As you will recall, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, a Yemeni national, was captured in November 2001 during the international armed conflict in Afghanistan. He has now been in U.S. custody for over 4.5 years, most of which have been spent in the detention camp in Guantanamo Bay, and some of it in prolonged solitary confinement. In July 2003, he was named under President Bush's military order of November 13, making him eligible for trial by military commission. Hamdan was charged with conspiracy to commit acts triable by military commission, such as attacking civilians and terrorism. The Hamdan lawsuit challenges the president's authority to establish military commissions in the absence of specific congressional action, and it also challenges the trial proceedings as violating the Constitution, U.S. military law, as well as the Geneva Conventions. The Center for Constitutional Rights filed two amicus briefs, that's so-called friend-of-the-court briefs, in support of Mr. Hamdan's case, arguing that the administration's military commission system, quote, violate the well-established norms of international humanitarian law, such as the Geneva Conventions, and challenging the legality of the Detainee Treatment Act. The court, last week, affirmed the applicability of fundamental protections under Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, specifically trials under, quote, regularly constituted courts, affording all the judicial guarantees recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. In early 2002, Bush determined that Common Article 3, which also prohibits torture, cruel, humiliating, or degrading treatment, did not apply to those detained by the U.S. in Afghanistan and the wider so-called War on Terror. Now, I think it's important for us to remember that the rights affirmed in Hamdan are rights that the rule of law recognizes for each of us. We have a right to be present at our own trial, to know what evidence will be presented against us, and to be defended by counsel. While the Bush administration has denied the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay these rights, its disdain for the judicial and legislative branches have greatly imperiled each of our own civil liberties. The court's decision in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld is a welcome signal to George Bush that he cannot continue to aggrandize and exploit the executive branch of government. As we've previously discussed on Law and Disorder, Verizon, AT&T, and other large telephone companies are suspected of providing the Bush administration's NSA with the personal emails and phone calling details of millions of customers. Aside from the lawsuits filed by the EEF, that's the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the ACLU, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, the New York Civil Liberties Union is demanding from the top three New York protection agencies, the Attorney General's Office, the Public Services Commission, and the Consumer Protection Board, to investigate this serious invasion of our privacy and to order the telephone companies to end this practice. We are delighted to have with us today Corey Stoughton, staff attorney with the New York Civil Liberties Union. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Corey.
Thank you.
So, Corey, we know what they're doing to us. What can we do about it?
You know, the first thing I would urge everybody to do is to write a letter to their phone company.
And cell phone and landline?
For now, we just know the only information we have is about landlines. There's basically a big black hole when it comes to cell phones and what the government and the phone companies might be colluding on in that sector. But what we know and what's come out in news reports is about landlines. And what we know is that the phone companies have, or at least the news reports have said that the phone companies have given private customer calling details to the NSA, the National Security Agency. And so the first thing I would do as a consumer is call my phone company. And in New York, the two primary phone service providers are Verizon and AT&T. And I would call and demand answers from them and call to register a complaint and let them know that people care about this. Because I think there's a feeling generally in the phone companies and definitely on the part of the Bush administration that they can get away with this because people don't care.
Have you called?
I have.
And what did they say?
Well, I called. Unfortunately, I don't have a landline. I'm one of those small percentage of people now who've given up the landline in favor of the cell phone. But I did call my cell phone company, which is Verizon, and I asked them if they were doing it with cell phones, and I haven't gotten a response.
If I was going to call when we get out of the studio, I'm going to call Verizon. And I got a cell phone and a landline because I'm older. And who do I talk to them? What do I say?
I don't have the numbers, but I would write a letter because I think that we get a paper trail on this, that there'll be, you know, kind of a signal to them that a lot of people are demanding answers about this. And I'm sure that if you just start with whatever numbers on their website for customer complaints, that would be a good place to start. I think that as, you know, our letter campaign that you mentioned in the introduction is part of this campaign to make sure that people understand that there's a growing movement behind this. When we first sent our letter on May 24th to the three state agencies that we sent it to, we, over a course of literally less than 48 hours, had gotten over 400 people to sign on to our demand for an investigation by these state authorities into what the phone companies have done. Since then, we sent an update letter actually just yesterday to two of those three agencies. As of yesterday, we had thousands of names of people who signed on and were calling for a demand for an investigation of what happened. So I think there's a movement here, and I just think we need to keep at it and make sure that the companies and the Bush administration know that we care.
Now, Corey, in addition to violating the phone company's own privacy policies, what they're doing violates New York law.
Well, it's interesting that you asked that question. There is actually quite a dearth of New York law protecting New Yorkers' privacy. And we were really disappointed to find that out when we looked into this issue. Unlike many, many other states which have express protections for consumer information, especially telephone information, there's no express protection in New York law that makes it either a criminal or civil penalty for when people share that information. But this does still appear to be illegal under New York law. If the phone companies did what these news reports say they did, it does still appear to be illegal because they said in their privacy policies, each one of these companies, AT&T and Verizon, each had a privacy policy that represented to all of us as customers that if we give them that information, our information would be kept private. And giving it to the NSA for the purposes of facilitating an illegal spying program clearly violates that promise to consumers. So it's a consumer protection problem. It's a fraud problem. And that's illegal under New York law. And that's the grounds why we think, you know, Attorney General Spitzer and the Consumer Protection Board really ought to open an investigation so that we know and we have answers and we can really find out what they did.
What are the answers that you're looking for? What specifically do you want to know?
Well, you know, I've been really disappointed with the phone companies and the kind of corporate doublespeak that they came out with after this whole scandal broke. Both Verizon and AT&T have been very ambiguous about what exactly they've done. And they're trying to hide. Now we see them trying to hide behind invocation of the state secrets doctrine, which I can talk a little bit more about.
Yeah,
about.
What is the state secrets doctrine?
Well, the state secrets doctrine is a doctrine that, you know, it's a very common sense doctrine. There are some things, you know, government spying on foreign governments and things like that that are, you know, very sensitive. And so back in history when, for example, a CIA agent might sue the CIA for firing him inappropriately, and the CIA wants to say, no, we fired you for cause because you were, you know, a bad spy and we have all these reasons, but we can't tell you them because it would divulge state secrets. You know, courts would say, okay, you know what, that's true, and we're going to, you know, limit our ability to hear this kind of controversy because it's so sensitive. But now the government has evolved, you know, expanded this doctrine to cover all kinds of things that might, they claim, will implicate our national security. And the real problem with the state secrets doctrine in this context is that it's kind of a smokescreen. We know what's going on. President Bush has gotten up in front of all the Americans and admitted that this spying program exists.
And I mean, not only admitted it, but said, hey, we did it and we have the right to do it.
Right.
And moreover, what are you worried about? You don't have something to hide, do you?
Yeah. And so we know what's going on. So why do we need to get into any state secrets? There's nothing secret here. It's all out in the open. But what really bothers me about this is the phone companies trying to hide behind this. Because this is not a doctrine from a legal standpoint, you know, talking as a lawyer, that's meant to protect private companies and corporate America. This is a doctrine that's meant to protect legitimate government secrets. If the CEO of Verizon, who, by the way, doesn't have a security clearance, knows about this stuff, the American public should know about it. And there's no way that the phone company should be able to duck answering questions, whether they're asked for by a consumer or asked by the Attorney General. There's no way they should be able to duck that by hiding behind this doctrine.
We're here, for listeners just tuned in, with Corey Stoughton from the New York Civil Liberties Union talking about how the phone company here, both of the major phone companies in New York, collaborating with the government in spying on us, privacy issue. Corey, tell us, what was your reaction when you heard about this?
Well, I was really disappointed because I knew we had a lot to fear from the Bush administration. And it's not that I ever thought that corporate America was our big, you know, friend and ally, but I was really disappointed to hear that these corporations weren't standing up for their consumers. Because, you know, like we said earlier, they have these privacy policies and they sell their services to us.
These corporations make their livelihood through individuals, and they owe us a duty of responsibility. And part of that responsibility is not to sell, to be giving our information to a government gone wild and demanding that they want to be able to spy on us through our corporate consumer contracts. This is illegal. And if it's not illegal under New York state law, it sure as heck should be.
So there was one company, Quest, out west, wasn't it?
When the original story broke in the USA Today, Quest was kind of the hero of the story. They were painted as the hero because their CEO had been interviewed by the people who wrote the article saying that while he was CEO, he had rejected requests from the NSA to turn over records.
Why was that?
He never really said why, but the implication in the story was that Quest was actually legitimately concerned for their consumers' privacy. Even that's a little bit ambiguous because that guy isn't the CEO of Quest anymore. Kind of gets to this whole issue. The corporations have been really not straightforward with answers. All of them have been very, you know, shady.
Well, I think this points to the nature of the corporation. Quite frankly, I'm not disappointed by this, and I'm not surprised by this. I'm just angry because this shows this is our government, again, leaning on corporations and corporations serving government interests and not the people that should be coming first here. It's the populations that elect these governments that should be making these decisions and coming first, and the populations that support these companies that should be able to have their privacy protected.
Well, Bell South did deny participating.
Oh, well, how do we sign up for them?
They did. They denied it straightforwardly.
Why? For what reasons?
Well, they didn't give any reasons. They just issued, they actually demanded that USA Today print a retraction. USA Today hasn't done, which is interesting. They're standing by their story. So you can always parse these statements. It's a little harder, I think, to parse Bell South's statement. It was a little bit more, you know, we deny what has been said in the USA Today article fairly straightforwardly. Verizon also got up in arms at first about the story, but their denial statement was just a hilarious example of corporate doublespeak. I mean, as a lawyer, I've written some convoluted things, I'll admit. But these guys must have the craziest lawyers on the planet. I mean, you look at what they wrote, and it's a yes-no complete doublespeak. And anybody, any normal person could read that and know that this was a really blatant attempt to not answer the question.
Well, that's what you get for $600 an hour.
Right,
well, AT&T hasn't denied it, though.
AT&T has not denied it. In fact, AT&T, I just read in the newspaper the other day, has just amended their privacy policy so that they no longer promise to keep their customer information about phone and email safe anymore.
But a couple of years ago, AT&T made the decision to stop going after new customers in terms of getting home services, and that they would just be courting corporate clients. So this is part of the whole screw you, we don't care. You have our service or you don't, but we're not really going to try to get your service, and we're not going the extra mile for you, or we're not even doing what's minimally expected.
You don't have to try to get your service. I mean, it's an oligopoly out there.
Yeah,
there's a handful of phone companies. They want to do to you.
That's a good question. Are there any phone companies out there who we do know haven't participated in this?
I wouldn't feel comfortable saying with 100% certainty that about anyone. I mean, you know, there's Quest, who has issued this denial, although it's a denial from a former CEO. There's Bell South that has issued this denial, and yet there seem to be, you know, reporters that are standing by sources they have that are telling them the opposite. So I don't know what to believe. And that's really why I think it's so important that we demand answers from government agencies that have subpoena power to get testimony under oath from these companies. We need to know so that we can make informed decisions as consumers which phone company is best protecting our privacy, because that's important to us.
Is that going to be happening here in New York?
Well, I hope so. So far, unfortunately, you know, you mentioned we sent this letter. And we have gotten a response from one of the state agencies already. That's the New York Public Services Commission. This is the regulatory agency that's charged with you know, it's in charge of the telephone companies and as a general matter. And they wrote back to say that they were not going to investigate. And we were really disappointed to hear that. And they claim their first reason for not investigating is they claim they have no jurisdiction to protect New Yorkers' privacy. Now, I find that hard to believe. I'm not an expert in telecommunications or regulatory law, but this is an agency that has regulatory authority over these companies and the statements they make. And so for them to say, you know, we're going to basically drop the ball on this was really disappointing. And it just makes it all the more important as we turn to these other agencies who we think have the power to do this, that they step up to the plate. And that's Attorney General Spitzer's office and the New York Consumer Protection Board.
And they haven't responded yet.
And they have not yet responded to our letter.
And this guy wants to be governor.
He does. He does. So we hope that he'll understand how important this is to New Yorkers, and we keep trying to update them with all of the New Yorkers who signed on, and if there are any listeners out there who want to go to our webpage, which is nyclu.org, there's a link there to sign on to our petition demanding an investigation, and we'll keep sending more and more
Excellent.
Names as they come in.
We'll put that up, Corey, on lawanddisorder.org. So Corey Stoughton of the NYCLU, thank you so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks
you, Corey.
A lot.
We're delighted to have with us Rachel Mirapol, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who worked on the recent Turtman v. Ashcroft case, with a decision by a federal judge in Brooklyn essentially ruling that immigrants can be indefinitely detained on the basis of religion, race, or national origin. Rachel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you give us a brief sort of summary of the case and what this decision means?
Sure. The Center for Constitutional Rights filed Turkman v. Ashcroft in 2002. Basically, it's a challenge to the post-9/11 domestic immigration detentions. Immediately after September 11th, hundreds of Arab and South Asian men were disappeared off the streets of Brooklyn. I did a lot of investigation initially, and nobody could figure out why the men were being held. Eventually, it came to light that these men were arrested under the authority of the immigration law, but were really being held in connection to the terrorism investigation. And they were being held not because there was any real evidence to connect them to any act of terrorism, but because they were Muslim, because they were Arab and South Asian, or perceived to be such, and because the United States took that status at that point as a reason to suspect someone of a connection to a crime. So we filed the case in 2002 as a class action.
What month in 2002?
April of 2002.
April. Yeah, it was really interesting because during that whole period, I remember just men disappearing up off the streets. There were women who thought that their husbands died in the World Trade Center, although they couldn't figure out how their husbands had been in the area because they just disappeared that day and didn't come home and they didn't hear anything for weeks.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the secrecy with which this policy was undertaken is one of the major problems. You know, there were incredible restrictions put in place upon the initial detention of the men to keep anyone from finding out where they were being held or why. So when people would come to us and say, you know, my husband's disappeared, my father's disappeared, I can't figure out where he is, we would begin, you know, calling the FBI, calling the NYPD, calling the INS. We'd find out that a man might be in a particular facility, and then we'd go to that facility to try to interview the guy, and the people at the facility would say, he's not here. We've never heard of him. And that was because the high-level government officials ordered that all of these detentions had to occur in complete secrecy, and that the men would have no access to the outside world during the beginning stages of their detention. So that meant that they couldn't call outside the facility where they were being detained. They couldn't receive visitors, phone calls, letters, nothing.
So what's happening is that right in the immediate aftermath after 9/11, law enforcement is going out on the streets and sweeping up Arab, Muslim, and South Asian immigrants with minor immigration violations, throwing them in a detention facility, not allowing them communication with the outside world, and not telling the outside world who's been picked up and why they're being held. So people are essentially just disappearing off the streets.
Yep, and all of this is really to facilitate interrogation. You know, the United States has stated in many contexts that when you want to interrogate someone, it's easier to do it if you can get them alone, if you can isolate them from the outside world. You have lawyers coming in telling them they have the right to remain silent. It gets in the way of that kind of interrogation. So really, there was a purposeful decision to isolate these men completely from the outside world.
Yeah, and Rachel, that decision of the judge recently confirms that they can now do this.
The judge said in a decision that was quite disappointing, really, on some levels, was that because the immigration law provides so much discretion to the executive, that after an individual is picked up on a valid immigration arrest and he's ordered removed from the United States can take its time in removing him and hold him for any purpose it wants during that post-removal order period. Any reason that it wants can include, you know, a decision to detain an individual because of their religion.
Is it just so long as someone has a minor immigration violation, they can be picked up for any reason and held without any kind of charge?
What's at issue here is the detention period after the final deportation or removal order. So at that point, under the immigration law, the executive has a certain period of time to effectuate the deportation. Under the immigration regulations, it's 90 days. Under a Supreme Court case called Zedvitas, in the event that there's difficulty arranging for the deportation itself, you know, the detainee's country doesn't want him back, say, refuses to take him back. Well, in that case, the United States can hold that individual for a six-month period of time. What the court held in Zedvitas is that at the point at which it's no longer reasonably foreseeable that individual will ever be deported, then the continued detention of the individual violates due process. And what Judge Gleason did is sort of turn that ruling on its head and say the United States can hold a detainee as long as it is reasonably foreseeable at some point in the future
that
they will be deported.
Tell me about some of your clients. Tell me their stories.
The guys I represent really have quite compelling stories to tell. Most of these men were working, living in the city. Some of them had lived here for quite a few years when they were arrested, minding their business, everyday guys. They were picked up shortly after 9/11, and from the moment of their arrest, they were treated as though they were terrorists. So, you know, out of nowhere, there's a knock on the door in the middle of the night. Maybe you're sleeping. Maybe you're hanging out with your roommates. Maybe you just got home from work and you're relaxing. There's a knock on the door, and 10 agents bust in the room with their guns drawn. From that moment on, my clients were treated as though they were terrorists. They were never shown what evidence the United States had against them to connect them to terrorism. But despite this fact, you know, they were placed in the most restrictive conditions of confinement imaginable. This means 23 to 24 hours a day lockdown in solitary confinement with the lights on 24 hours a day, guards videotaping them inside their cells and outside their cells. Every time they were moved from their cell, they were placed in handcuffs and shackles and waist chains and moved with four guards on all sides of them, surrounding them. Their only visitation was through plexiglass while they remained in their handcuffs and shackles. And despite all of these protections, they were still strip searched before and after any visitation. So they were treated just in mind-bogglingly restrictive and punitive ways, despite the fact that none of my clients were charged with a crime at that point. None of them were charged with any criminal offense, much less an offense related to terrorism.
You know, and what scares me, and now that the judge has given the government the green light to continue doing this, that I understand there's some 11 million people who are in the status that your clients are in the United States. And we also had some discussion on our program weeks ago about the internment camps that the Kellogg Brown and Root, a subsidiary of Halliburton, just got $387 million to start building. So what happened to your clients could happen at a wholesale level.
Absolutely. And I think it's a terrifying possibility. The kind of discretion that the judge has held that the United States has in this area really is huge. I mean, the fact that, you know, immigration law can now be used under this decision as a pretext to hold an individual who you want to investigate for any reason is really terrifying. I mean, we think about the fact that citizens in the United States do have so much protection if they're suspected of a crime. I mean, I think the most basic question is, why are non-citizens not deserving of that same protection?
Is this the first time that this kind of distinction has been drawn?
Well, unfortunately, in our law, it goes back for a while that there's some difference in the way courts will review or scrutinize decisions that relate to immigration. So, for instance, when the executive makes a decision about what kind of immigrants it wants to allow into the country, whether it's going to be more inviting to citizens from certain countries versus others, those decisions generally get very, very deferential judicial review. However, I think that this is the first time that the courts have moved beyond that kind of analysis of decisions made specifically about immigration law and instead held that in detaining an individual, in asserting the complete power to detain someone without charges, not pursuant to a specific immigration law or policy, the court shouldn't get involved in scrutinizing that type of decision. So I think this is a real expansion of the doctrine.
Now, Rachel, in the wake of this decision, what plans, if any, does the Center for Constitutional Rights have?
Well, we are planning to appeal, and we think we have a great chance before the Second Circuit. So that's what we'll do. In the meantime, the case is going forward on some of the other claims.
What claims are those?
Well, the claims challenging the conditions of confinement in the detention center where they were held, Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. The judge did allow that those claims could go forward, not just against the wardens of the facility and the correctional officers and supervisors who abused my clients directly and held them in the conditions, but also against the high-level government officials who we believe were responsible for ordering that my clients and the other post-9/11 detainees be held in such restrictive confinement in the first place.
So who are you going to get to depose in terms of high-level government people?
Well, as of now, we have John Ashcroft, Robert Mueller, and James Ziegler all on the hook in this case.
Great.
Three of our favorite people. So, Rachel, one last question. If you were Emma Lazarus instead of Rachel Mirapol, and you were going to write a poem to place at the base of the Statue of Liberty about how you treat your tired and huddled masses yearning to be free, what would you say about how they treated these people?
Oh, be careful, be careful. I mean, clearly we are not the welcoming country that we claim to be when we decide that it's okay to allow racial, religious, ethnic discrimination against people just because they're non-citizens and thus in some way not deserving of the protections that we all hold dear.
Rachel, one last question. Tell us about one specific client and his particular story that really stands out for you.
I think that it's hard to choose one individual since I feel very close to all of my clients at this time. I guess one of the first ones that I spoke to after the decision came down, so the first guy that I really had to tell about what had happened here, is Yasser Ibrahim, and he's spoken quite at length to the press before about sort of how he feels about his claims and how he feels about this case. And he's back in Egypt now living with his brother. He came back to the United States recently to be deposed in this case. And so I know him a little better.
So they let him back in. They let him back in for the case.
Because he's suing him.
Exactly.
So what happened to Yasser Ibrahim?
Well, he was arrested shortly after 9/11, like many of the others. He was arrested with his brother. And so I think, you know, one of the hardest parts for him probably is going through all of this, you know, feeling like you have to take care of somebody else as well as yourself and seeing all the terrible things that were done to his brother in front of him.
Where was he when he was arrested?
He was at his home in Brooklyn. He lives actually not very far from, he used to live not very far from where I live now in Brooklyn, actually,
so
in the Kensington neighborhood.
Who came to get him?
He was arrested by a combination of FBI, INS, and NYPD officers.
Wow. All that law enforcement, they just show up at his door?
Right. Imagine like 9 different officers crowding into a small Brooklyn apartment, you know, out of nowhere.
With guns pulled.
Guns drawn. Exactly.
We'd always make the caricature of the Nazis, you know, the knock on the door in the middle of the night.
We have the same thing here in Brooklyn.
Right. It's absolutely terrifying. You know, when I spoke to Yasser after the decision came down, and he was really disappointed about what had happened. And I think that's really the hardest part for all of us here is that I think that the reason why my clients have been willing to move forward with this case, have been so interested in pushing it forward despite the fact that it's been several long years of struggle now, is because they don't want what happened to them to happen to anyone else.
Wow.
And I think that, you know, the fact that the judge's ruling could be seen as a green light to carry on the kind of racial profiling that we saw after 9/11, that fact is very difficult for them to hear.
Rachel Mirapol, the one good thing, I think, is they've got you out there fighting for them. Rachel Mirapol from the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you very much for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Bye, Rachel.
As it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shot up and back in chains, to deny us of the future, rob our name, kept my history a mystery, but now I see, the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me, promised for freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery, and now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold, with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told, promised me emancipation, and this new nation. All you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Sat lying about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down so they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power. Panther power from the strength that resides within.
in. Go toe-to-toe with the panther and you just can't win. Self-proclaimed best, suppress the rest. The rich get richer and the poor take less. The American dream was an American nightmare. You kept my people down and refused to fight fair. The Ku Klux Klan tried to keep us out. We signed truth and state no blacks allowed. With intimidation and segregation was the way for freedom, but now we're impatient. Blacks, the other skin, yeah, don't sell out. Freedom, equality, get out, yell out. Don't you never be ashamed of what you are. It's your panther power that makes you a star. Panther power. My mother never let me forget my history, hoping I was set free. Chains I would put on me, wanted to be more than just free. Had to know the true facts about my history. I couldn't settle for being.
You're on Law and Disorder. We've discussed at length how police and the FBI have spied on and infiltrated activist groups. On December 26 of last year, Law and Disorder brought Eileen Clancy from Eyewitness Video to the program to talk about how her video coverage had exposed the NYPD's covert joining in with vigils and rallies of activists. We now take a deeper look at how the charge of conspiracy is being used to take down individuals within environmental protest groups in the United States, and how it's used to impose especially harsh prison sentences. The National Lawyers Guild recently sponsored the event, What is the Green Scare? How the Government is Targeting Eco-Activists. We have more details and a link to listen to the entire event on our website, lawanddisorder.org. Today, we'll hear from three attorneys. First, Daniel Myers, a New York City criminal defense lawyer practicing since 1967. Second, attorney Andrew Erba, who specializes in state and federal criminal defense and civil rights actions. And lastly, Lauren Regan, a public interest attorney practicing environmental law, civil rights, and criminal defense. We now listen to an excerpt from Daniel Myers, who describes how political activists are targeted through the use of federal conspiracy statutes. He explains that once a charge of conspiracy is accepted by the judge, hearsay is admissible, making conspiracy, as he called it, the easiest charge to prove in court.
Movements and groups are demonized. Movements and people are co-opted when doing political work, people's work, mass movement work. Our groups and organizations are infiltrated when co-option and other forms of intimidation or psychological propaganda, divisions, playing on people's fears, suspicions about each other fail. There also are assassinations, as I previously referenced. And what is in the hands of the government that's been their tool, their major tool, once they ultimately criminalize groups and members of groups? What do they have? They have 18 United States Code, Section 371, and some of its spin-offs, which is the conspiracy law. It is a law that is the most easily brought and the most easily proved. It creates within it the circumstances of people becoming internally frightened by the way that law operates, and that invariably, but often not in political cases, there are people who flip. So you start with a situation in which invariably there's going to be one or more informers, there is going to be surveillance, there's going to be wiretaps, legal and illegal. There's going to be the whole range of collection of information and evidence under what is an agreement to do something wrong. And under U.S. conspiracy law, and not many countries have a conspiracy law, and not many states have a conspiracy law, and states that do have a conspiracy law, it's considered to be a lesser included offense, a lesser offense. Under U.S. law, a conspiracy, an agreement to do something wrong, is oftentimes punished more severely than doing the actual harm. This is what this government is presently doing. As I said, the connection between the past and the present is essentially using the same exact laws, the same exact tools, and the questions that we as lawyers always need to do is to understand the reality of the times, the reality of the use of the law, and to counsel each other and our clients in a confidential manner. The use of emails to communicate, I think, is a real mistake. I'm very glad that you're here. We're going to hear now from people who are going to be working day and night to defend their clients against these kind of draconian laws, with a government fully geared up to put their clients away for many, many years.
That was Daniel Myers speaking at the Green Scare Forum. We now hear from Andrew Erba, one of the lawyers for the Shack 7 Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty defendants. Erba deepened the analysis with a discussion of the plight of defendants facing federal conspiracy charges, such as accused drug dealers.
Thank you very much for having me. On the train up from Philadelphia, I mean, I was caused to think how, when I was a law student, I used to sit where you were and have what I thought were great lawyers talk and inspire me. And I always, in the back of my mind, said, well, you know, is what they're saying really real? And I'd like to start out, before I talk about the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty case, with some reality. Because I think that it's easy for people who are in the guild and people who do political activism to think that somehow they're a special breed. And the truth is, the conspiracy things that we just talked about and the laws that we're going to talk as it applies to activists have been applied for years and continue to be applied to the African-American community, to drug dealers, or what the government sees as drug dealers, unfortunately to those that they see as organized crime, and in fact, anyone that the government wishes to prosecute. And so the point that I'd like to make is, and I'd like to tell you a little story to illustrate this point, is that there is a moment that we can draw some benefit from what we're seeing. And if that moment only allows us to understand that, at least in my opinion, and I'm just a simple criminal defense attorney from Philadelphia, and I don't speak for anyone other than myself, but if it allows us to realize that in our middle class, we have not understood exactly what the government's been doing to the African-American community, then there's going to be some benefit, because what I do for the most of my practice is represent individuals who the government thinks are drug dealers. And 99% of those people, you know, are arrested with guns. 99% of those people have long histories. And I'd say 99.9% of those people are African-American males. And 100% of those African-American males that are convicted do 20, 30, 40 years in the federal court system. And in the wisdom of the federal government, because they all have the cleverness that we don't as normal people have, they have the expertise to be able to get on the stand, put their hand under oath, and look a jury in the eye and say, yo, come to my crib, drug talk. Yo, I'm going to be there, drug dealing. And that is the kind of evidence that the government would put in against Jose to show a conspiracy with his cousin, which will put him in very serious trouble. And Jose's trouble comes from the fact that the government is alleging this major drug operation with hundreds of thousands of kilos of cocaine being sold. And as a conspirator, even in the smallest part where he had that one conversation, Jose is responsible for every dollar that they say was sold, for every kilo that was sold, for everything that goes down on anybody in that. That weight will fall on Jose. He's just a small part of it. Now, what does this story mean to us? Well, it seems unfair, but the truth of the matter is, that's how the federal government makes cases. And let me also illustrate this story by an example of what's happening. In an indictment, there's 10 defendants, usually. Maybe there's 20 defendants. Now, as was explained to you, the federal laws are so draconian, the penalties are so harsh, and let's be honest, the people they arrest all have criminal records, which bump up their exposure, that everybody who's at the top tries to cut a deal. And the way you cut a deal is to give up somebody, and they give up the person underneath them. And so the way it works in a pyramid that the federal government does is indict 20 people. Okay, number one talks on number two. Number two talks on number three. That goes down the line. So the point being that a conspiracy from the federal perspective is an opportunity for them to get any number of people to turn on anybody else. And the way they make these cases are traditionally in two ways. As stated, they have informers. Now, the informers are usually people that they arrest on charges, and those people have to give up information because they're facing penalties too. And then they have what are traditionally known as wiretaps, and they have right now internet taps. Now, the point being, I guess, of this long story is that, you know, these things aren't new. And I think that the fact that we're here today saying they're applying to activists or they're applying to people in the environmental movement or the animal rights movement only shows how little everybody who does political activity understands what goes on. Because I'm telling you, this isn't new for the federal government. It isn't new for the FBI. They've been doing this for years, and they're very good at it. And the truth of the matter is, I represented hundreds of activists that always tell me, boy, I'm going to go to the wall. Let them arrest me. And I look them in the eye, and I say, look, I'm a criminal defense attorney, and I have to tell you bitter news. The last place you want to be is a defendant. And the last place you want to be is a defendant in federal court.
That was Andrew Erba, Philadelphia attorney and counsel for one of the defendants in the Shack 7 Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty 7 case. Lastly, we hear an excerpt from Oregon attorney Lauren Regan. Regan is a public interest lawyer specializing in environmental law, civil rights, and criminal defense. During her talk, Regan illustrated the arbitrary nature of criminalizing dissent by listing numerous historic civil disobedience cases that were dismissed by judges as honorable actions.
The Green Scare defendants that I'm working with, the indictments are alleged to be property damage by sabotage. There was no harm to any living being and no intent to harm any living being. The incidents alleged in these indictments were acts of sabotage, which I will mention, even some of our most famed historians have indicated that sabotage was deemed a form of civil disobedience historically. This type of civil disobedience, this form of sabotage, has been used in resistance movements since the birth of this nation's democracy. For instance, the Boston Tea Party, pretty common example, in 1773, probably one of the most striking examples of the use of sabotage done for a noble purpose, the resistance to tyranny in England. In the 1850s, there were a number of instances where anti-slavery activists stole property, meaning slaves, broke into courthouses and police stations in order to rescue ex-slaves being returned to their masters due to the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. In many of those instances, the people were acquitted by a jury of their peers that felt that although the government and the prosecutors claimed that these were crimes, human rights and the law of society deemed them to not be crimes. In the book There Is a River by historian Vincent Harding, he wrote, "The struggle over fugitives, heightened over the decades by the relentless civil disobedience of individuals and committees, played a central role in forcing the system of slavery to its breaking point. The sit-down strikes of 1936 and 37 violated laws of private property, but were a part of the campaign to work for workers' rights. The labor movement, as many in this room are probably more savvy to than I am, used sabotage and fire and other forms of disobedience in order to win the five-day work week and the eight-hour work day, things that we would look back upon and think were noble now, but were crimes, and many people were imprisoned for those actions. The courts have acknowledged that free speech is not confined to verbal behavior, but can extend to symbolic actions. For instance, in 1966, there was a case, Brown v. Louisiana, where the Supreme Court said that the principle of free speech is not confined to verbal expression. And the role of civil disobedience in general, which sabotage is one such tactic, has played a pivotal role in the formation of our democracy. In the book Wise Minority by Leon Friedman, he says, there is hardly a reform movement in the history of the United States that did not feel it necessary or desirable to violate established laws as part of its campaign for justice. And at the time of the disruptive acts of the Shays Rebellion in Massachusetts in 1786, even Thomas Jefferson said, the spirit of resistance to government is so valuable on certain occasions that I wish it to be always kept alive. During the Vietnam War, we saw the burning of draft records, recruiting stations, and more. A number of these people were also convicted and jailed. In 1974, in Western Massachusetts, anti-nuclear protester Sam Lovejoy committed an act of sabotage by toppling a 500-foot tower that was a precursor for a nuclear power plant. And the judge saw this not as an ordinary crime, but as an act of civil disobedience, and he dismissed the case. In the 1980s, starting with the Plowshares 8 in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, religious pacifists poured blood on nuclear missiles and conducted many other such actions of sabotage. The juries found the defendants guilty, but in some of the cases, there were hung juries and acquittals. And often, jurors felt the only reason that they convicted these people was because the judge gave them no choice but to convict based on the jury instructions. You know, as Danny mentioned, those jury instructions are pretty binding. In the pending eco-crimes, the alleged intent of the defendants, according to some of the websites that have been set up, was not to cause damage to any human being, was not to overthrow the government of the United States or cause murder and mayhem, as we've seen in recent years, by actual terrorist groups, but was to make a statement about an important social issue. In short, these people are not criminals in the ordinary sense of the word. Their acts were acts of civil disobedience, not criminal disobedience.
That was an excerpt from a speech delivered by Oregon attorney Lauren Regan. For more information on the Green Scare Forum, please visit lawanddisorder.org. You can download our entire program, listen to the entire Green Scare Forum, or let us know what you think. Law and Disorder will continue to report on the spying of activist groups around the United States. Just this past Friday, the LA Times reported that Governor Schwarzenegger's office, in charge of protecting Californians against terrorism, has been tracking anti-war and political demonstrations in what is a clear abuse of people's First Amendment rights. Details about rallies that were monitored were reported by SRA International, a company hired to provide counterterrorism analysis. Activities reported on in California included an animal rights rally in San Francisco to protest the hunting of seals, a Women's International League for Peace and Freedom gathering in Santa Barbara in support of an anti-war protester, and a demonstration in Walnut Creek, where U.S. Representative George Miller spoke out against the war in Iraq.
Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.